Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are talking Beyoncé. That's right, Beyoncé, and the role she played in helping Tottenham become the richest club in London. We'll also be talking about Chelsea, the transfer window and the FA Cup. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we've got our irreplaceable chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel.
Believe me, they've tried.
And a former footballer who was something of a survivor after a 14-year career in four tiers of the Football League. It's Gregor Robertson. Listen, I've made you both laugh and I've mentioned Beyoncé on the podcast.
It's all downhill from here, folks, honestly.
Absolutely. We had hoped Tony Cascarino would join us too, but unfortunately he can't be here, which is a huge relief as I couldn't work out which Beyoncé or Destiny's Child song to link him to. So moving on. Mission complete. Mentioned Beyoncé on the Game podcast. I can retire now. And we go to the home fans at Stamford Bridge who were jumping on Tuesday night. That's it. There's no more. That's it. I promise.
These all go over my head. I must warn you.
No, come on. You know.
I got that one, but don't try anymore.
Survivor. You know Survivor.
Okay, I'll get that one. Yeah,
you must have been playing that when you were coming back from your injuries back in the day in the physio's room working it out. You must have known that one, sure.
I know that one, yeah.
And you've got a daughter. You've got to be raising it on Beyoncé.
Yeah, she's too young for Beyoncé, but I'm sure it'll come.
I'm sure it'll come. Anyway, so as I was saying, jumping, Tuesday night, Beyoncé. We're there.
It's just really good. Honestly, I think we've shifted 50% of the audience to Radio 4 already.
Well, listen, my fiancé might be listening because at least I mentioned Beyoncé. But darling, you can turn away now because it's back to the football. Chelsea, 6-1 winners against Middlesbrough. Something of a statement result. Lots of people will be saying, yeah, but it's only Middlesbrough. But they did have a job to do, didn't they, Martin? And they did it in a bit of style.
They had two jobs to do. In fact, the first job was to level the tie, and the next job was to win the tie, and they did them both within 30 minutes of kickoff, which I was impressed by. And you know, it's only Middlesbrough, notwithstanding, you've still got to do it. And six goals is still a statement. They corrected the problem that they had in the first leg, which was that they couldn't score, and dried up in front of goal, and the goals came, and I thought it was a very impressive performance, and I keep saying that there's a good team at Chelsea trying to get out, and it's going to take time, and it might not be this season, although they're in the final, but next season with a bit more time. As long as I don't do anything stupid with Pochettino, there is the semblance of a team coming there.
What do you think? You've been critical of Chelsea at times this season, very critical of some of their performances when they lost against Manchester United. You referenced them being one of the worst performances.
That was dreadful.
What is it you're seeing that you think will make them into a team eventually? What is it? Is it certain players or is it Pochettino's tactics, style?
I think Pochettino is getting it. A bit more organised there. I think there are a number of players that look to me to be confidence players, and they needed a run of games in which they could begin to grow. I'm thinking of Enzo Fernandez, who has never looked to me anything like the player that we believed they were getting. But suddenly you see certain things. There's a little bit of a sort of small change in the way that he's being used now. which I think has helped him. I think Caicedo is another confidence player. And I've said, you know, if you look at his price and Declan Rice's price, Declan Rice looks three times the player. But, again, you know, you can see it coming, and there's pace in the team, and they need an outlet. They need a centre forward. They really do need a goal scoring threat. I'd still be worried that their best defender is Thiago Silva rather than the other guys that they bought. Ben Chilwell makes a huge difference. They've got Reece James to come back. Reece James's injury record, you can't really rely on Reece James at the moment because of his injury record. But at the same time, when you're going through the team, you're looking at it thinking, he's a player.
Mm.
It's coming together. It's slowly coming together.
Yeah, speaking of critics of Chelsea, Gregor Robertson, welcome to the Game Podcast again. they're a team that you've picked out plenty of times, aren't they? So are you in Martin's camp? Are you seeing little shoots of hope? Or are you still quite dismissive of their options?
Yeah, but I wouldn't say that there are shoots of hope we haven't seen before. It's about consistency now. Mm-hmm. And look, there's no doubt that the loss of certain players has been huge, and Chilwell immediately changes the outlook of this team in terms of the balance.
But is there not something on... I was discussing this in the office the other day and talking about, hey, shock, Tom Allnutt wrote his piece from Stamford Bridge about, oh, Chilwell's back and look what happens. Is there not something on a manager when... You're just looking at Reece James and Chilwell and, oh, well, when they're back, we'll be all right. But then, at the same time, they're two players with terrible injury records. Should there not be a plan B that he could have worked out at some point?
Well, yeah, but I think you probably could level that accusation at the guys overseeing the recruitment more than Mauricio Pochettino.
That's fair.
Like, because I think in Tom Allnutt's piece, he said they've played 11 games. Reece James and Ben Chilwell have played 11 games together since the Champions League final. I think it was since the Champions League final. Anyway, not a lot. And, like, I think they lose 18% of the games with them both in the team, and it jumps to 33% when they're not playing. So, like, it's obvious, but it's not just about having him in the team. It's what it does to the rest of the team. Balance. Colwell can go back inside to what is clearly his more favoured position.
Yeah.
Even De Sassi looked like, although he's been playing central defence and he's a central defender on the right, kind of marauding runs down the right. Certainly a lot more things to be encouraged by here. Mudrick again was a bit kind of anonymous. I agree. There are green shoots for Chelsea, but there have been before. It's about, you know, we need to see them blossom now.
Mm. Do you think if they win this final, it can kind of paper over any other problems for the rest of, you know, they've got Aston Villa in the fourth round of the FA Cup this weekend. That'll be a difficult match. Then they play Liverpool in the league. They've got City in the league to come as well, and Tottenham before the end of February. There's not necessarily any promise there that they'll start shooting up the table with this result, is there?
No, but we said a few weeks ago after the first game at the Riverside that the end of this month was big for them. You know, progressing in the Cups and, as you say, a game against Liverpool. And it's quite interesting. I think Chilwell, Thiago Silva and James, if he's fit, are the only three players remaining from the Champions League final squad. Mm. There are a couple who are involved, but they're on their way out the door, I think, like Chalobah. We've said it so often, the Chelsea that, you know, what Chelsea were known for, this kind of team of serial winners, it's been completely torn up. That shows that getting to a final, playing at Wembley, potentially winning a trophy, it actually, you know, it's easy to say this will be important for them, but it will be. It will be important for them to kind of, you know, acquaint themselves with what Chelsea expect to be doing, challenging for silverware. So, yeah, I think it could be important. But having said all that, they still got to beat Liverpool in the final, and that's going to be, you know, no mean feat.
Martin, just coming back to a point you made earlier about Fernandes and Caicedo and being confidence players, is that a potential problem? The fact that they're both in a similar position, it's a key pivotal position, and they're both confidence players.
Well, it's not if you're feeling confident.
But you might not after Aston Villa and Liverpool.
Yeah, you don't want flakiness in that position. That's meant to be your sort of anchor position, really. But it's just something that this season you've looked at and thought, well, that guy, neither of those guys are looking anything like players that would be worth that sort of money. Neither of them. And then the last few games I've seen, they've just it seems to have gelled a little bit more.
Hmm.
It seems to have gelled a little bit more. You know, price tags, even Paul Pogba, who looked like a guy that was so full of confidence and everything, even Paul Pogba talked about the fee when he went to Manchester United and the weight of that and the pressure of that. So I think it does affect players, some players.
Chelsea will be hoping that they can keep that confidence up, but as I say, a tricky run of fixtures to come. They face Liverpool in the final. They progressed past Fulham in their semi-final. I don't want to dwell too much on Liverpool and their season because we talked about it on Monday, but I want to talk about Mohamed Salah, his injury with Egypt looking a little bit more serious than we first thought. How much will that impact Liverpool's thinking going forward? I mean, we were talking, Gregor, on Monday with Alisson about the forward options. You were kind of quite excited about all the different attacking talent that they've got in the squad, but at the same time, it's a different conversation and a different narrative when you think Mo Salah's missing a couple of games to when you then go, oh, this hamstring injury is a little bit worse. Does that kind of put a cloud over the club at the minute?
Look, if they don't have Salah in the team, they're diminished, that's clear. But everything that we said on Monday is true. They've got options and they've got real depth in attacking areas. And other players are stepping up. Diaz was a real threat, I thought, last night. Nunes had moments, the moment where he kind of did a 360 kind of spin just on the edge of the box. And
good play, I told you on Monday, you wouldn't
listen. Yeah, a few more goals would be nice. But they have got so many options. And there was a stat in Paul Joyce's piece, I think, about the number of games that Salah's missed. And I think they've only lost two of like 30 something.
Yeah.
So actually, when you bore down to it, they've done okay when he has been absent. You know, that's going over quite a long period of time. But I think at the moment, the way they're looking, and with, even as I said before, with like young players coming in and stepping up too, that's like just another sort of, that's adds to the feeling of buoyancy about the team. It does. It's like that's something that makes a team and a club feel better about themselves, I think. So, like, Jarrell Quansah was outstanding.
Yeah.
We've spoken about Conor Bradley. Harvey Elliott looks like he can be a starter for this Liverpool team now. So all of those things are all positive. Yes, Salah's a big loss, but at the moment it looks like they can absorb it.
I guess the thing with that list, as you mentioned with Paul Joyce, over the years without Salah, is for a lot of those years they had Sadio Mane potentially as well, if he was injured or not. Do they have a Mane? Do they have a next player? You know, because those two worked in tandem so much and were so effective and were often seen as joint stars, if you like. Martin, do you think of that group of attackers that they've got, Diaz, Jota, Nunes,
Gakpo,
do they have a player ready to step up in the way that Mane might have in the past?
They have a collection. They don't necessarily, I think, have one player that is as important as Mane was at his absolute peak for them, perhaps. But they have got a fabulous collection of forward players. They really have. That most teams in most clubs in Europe, outside the Premier League, would swap for tomorrow. The Salah thing is, I suppose what you'd say is that in one of the matches in which they haven't got Salah, there could be a chance that falls to somebody that Salah would have taken because he's next level, that doesn't get taken. And then it's whether that becomes significant or not. And that's what you mean, you know, because if you look at it in terms of, you know, like numbers or percentages or whatever, you know, there's not that much difference between Salah and some of their other forwards, but it's that 5 or 10% difference right at the very, very, very top end where he'll do something that nobody else can do. And that's the margins. That's the margin. You know, when people talk about marginal gains, that's what a marginal gain is. It is it's a 5% elevation from the norm. And that's what Mo Salah gives you.
Yeah, what do you think of the debate around Darwin Nunes on Monday? Gregor and I were... Did we fall out a little? Maybe a smidge? By our standards? By our standards? I think he's showing promise. I think 10 goals and 10 assists. But no, you were slightly more disparaging about him, saying you want to see more goals, you want to see more clinical
finishing.
Everyone says,
oh, look, he's firing, he's in great form. He had scored one goal in 16 games before that.
That's absolutely
So what we need is to see it consistently. That's all I was saying.
It's coming back to the Chelsea point. I completely with Gregor completely on the Chelsea point that, yeah, it's green shoots, but you've got to see it consistently. Same with Nunes, the same with anyone. It's anyone can, a good couple of games for a centre forward is not the same as the presence of a guy like Salah or the presence of a guy like Haaland or whatever, who you just know you can rely on every single week. You can rely on them.
I had someone contact me on Twitter, Andrew Coulton, who said, why are you holding him to the standards of a 30 goal a season striker when only 10?
That's Darwin Nunes.
He's having a go, yeah.
He's outside. Anytime you want, Sonny says.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'll tell him later. I'm busy. Someone got in touch with me and said, like, why are you holding him to the standards of a 30 goal a season striker when only 10 strikers in Premier League history have done so? I've reached that target. And I'm not holding him to that standard. I'm saying that, he could cost £85 million. Hmm. He's one of a group of players that Liverpool invested in with an eye on replacing the best front three in their modern history.
Yeah.
Sadio Mane and Salah, who's in his 30s now. And I don't think I'm not convinced yet that he's going to reach the heights of a Salah or one of the 10 strikers who are all, amazing strikers.
Can you remember
the list? Well, there was like Andy Cole, Henry,
yep.
Shearer.
Yep. Cristiano Ronaldo, Robin van Persie, Luis Suarez, Mo Salah, Harry Kane, and the left field shout, the bloke who not only the first Englishman to win the European Golden Shoe, playing for Sunderland, Kevin Phillips.
Yeah.
1999-2000.
The other thing to say is that,
Kevin Phillips will score a hell of a lot of goals when he was Liverpool centre forward.
Well, this comes to my point that the game's changed in the time between a lot of those strikers and now, and that Liverpool's dominance, like the points tallies they're getting, they might not be winning the Premier League every time, but that's because of Man City. They would win the league in almost all of those seasons. Mm. So the number of chances that he's getting and the number of goals that a striker could score in a Liverpool team is greater than a lot of those players who were often creating goals for themselves, some of them.
Yeah.
And Phillips wasn't, but a lot of them were like, they could create a goal out of nothing. This team is kind of constructed to score a lot of goals. The structure should provide a lot of chances for a striker, and in clutch moments he often misses. He's still a brilliant player, and as you said, having 10 goals and 10 assists at this point in the season is a great achievement.
People talk about the hard part. I don't know what you think about this, Greg. We go, I did the hard part. Oh, you hear it on comments all the time. He did the hard part. And you go, no. That last bit, that's the hard part. The bit before it, that's great. But the hard part is that bit. If Timo Werner, Ange Postecoglou made this point when they said about, are you worried about his form at Leipzig? And he said, well, not really, because if he was in great form at Leipzig, we wouldn't be able to afford him. And that's true. If Timo Werner could do the bit that's not meant to be the hard part, Tottenham wouldn't be able to afford him.
Hmm.
That bit where you put the ball away, that's the real hard part. And Timo Werner can do the rest of it fantastically well. Fantastically well. Beautiful player. In front of goal, something is not quite there. And it's absolutely crucial. I completely agree with what Greg was saying about Darwin Nunes. They create an awful lot of chances, Liverpool. They've got... One's coming back from injury and the other's injured. But under normal circumstances, as the two fullbacks, they've got two of the greatest supply lines in the history of English football, in Andrew Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold. That's an incredible supply line. The amount of chances that are being created by their two fullbacks alone. is a centre forward's dream.
Yeah, and none of this is to say he's not a fantastic footballer.
I'll stop doing your political answer.
That's
God's
the
sake.
Truth, though. It's like, you know, two things can be true. I'm just saying, you know, it's okay to try and measure him against the very best because that's what Liverpool need him to be soon.
Well, he might not have texted you, Martin, but Darwin, if you're listening, start banging the goals in so we can clip up these two negative Nellies. Martin, I just wanted to finish on Liverpool because I like to link the shows on Thursdays and Mondays. On Monday, we were talking about them in the title race and the wider ramifications of their current form and Salah and things. Do you see them as head-to-head with City? Is it two-horse race now?
Oh, do I don't think, know if it's a two-horse race.
Do you think Arsenal is still in? We were talking about the broader
you know, if we could do clairvoyance, we'd call this, you know, clairvoyancy with Martin and Gregor we could all win the polls and knock off for the year. So, but...
Get Joe Lewis on.
It's but yeah. Look, I think it could be. I think it could end up a two-horse race. I think we have this every single year, where everyone's going, "Oh, it's going to be really exciting." There's four teams in it, and then suddenly by mid-February, there's two teams in it, and so it could be like that again. But if it boils down to two teams being in it, Liverpool will be one of them, without a shadow of a doubt.
Well, the title race could have been influenced by the January transfer window. There were lots of speculations and rumours. Ivan Toney will be going to Arsenal. Will Liverpool sign any more players to add to their squad? Turns out no one's really signing anyone. Martin Samuel just finishing his coffee there.
No, sure, I'm not finishing. There's more of that to come.
Oh, right, revved up for the rest of the
show. Do you
know,
it's because of these little... You know, like when they were... When they started putting these like tiny little holes on the cap on the top... I don't know why you don't just get a coffee like you used to. I'm going to take this off and then you won't hear any more slurping
noises. You could have saved the lid. We'll have Eco Warriors onto us now, as well as people angry about our views on Darwin Nunes. But anyway, the transfer window. Martin, you've got views onto why people haven't been spending any money in this window.
Yeah, well, if you keep deducting 10 points from everybody, everyone's fighting out their lives to spend any money now. Congratulations, lads. Congratulations, Richard and everybody. You've turned us into Serie A and the Bundesliga and all of these other leagues where no one ever buys anybody. Your trickle-down economy's gone up the wall. All of it, you know, because the Everton 10-point deduction has arrived like a freeze on English football. Everyone is frightened out of their life. That's why everyone just wants to do loan transfers now. Oh, let's borrow a player. Let's try and win the league with somebody else's stock.
Do you think this is worse, though, than previous seasons? Because I kind of, you know, from the editing side, we always like look at, you know, James and I and my other colleagues on the editing desk as the January window, and no one's really going to buy anyone, are we? You know, we speak to Paul Joyce and Paul Hurst, the guys who cover these big clubs, and they go, they're not really going to do anything. No, they might
and then
move.
They do it.
But do they then?
Lewis Suarez came in January.
That's going a while back, though.
There's been a few. I was reading a piece with Harry Redknapp only this week talking about the various deals that he did in January. You know, some of his proudest moments, you know, was a January transfer that really came off, like I say, Paolo Di Canio, for instance. No, it's everyone's fine. You speak to clubs at the moment and... Oh, no, we don't want to just in case, because everyone is maxed out to a limit that is, as we have discussed, I have discussed on previous programmes. I'm not expecting everyone to agree with me, but is a sort of random cap that was put in 2014, and we think it's still applicable 10 years later. And now everyone's fighting to do business.
Is there anything wrong with the setup? Looking at it from, instead of looking at it from the FFP side and things, in terms of the transfer window with this kind of summer grouping, I actually wonder whether it's developed into quite a good way of running football clubs, and you do your business in the summer, you get your manager in place, you work out what style you're going to go for, and you maybe apply it and stick with it, and maybe seeing fewer sackings, managers, things like that. Is that not a good thing? And that maybe actually the January window, do we even need it?
Do we need the January? No, we don't need the January transfer window.
We don't need
the summer transfer window either. We don't need
so
any
you
transfer
think that,
window.
That's what I mean. So you think they should be scrapped and
yeah,
just
no
let
transfer
it get...
window. I've never believed in the transfer window. I've always thought it was another ridiculous set of red tape that, for some reason, football loves red tape. They love wrapping themselves in rules that don't apply in any other business. If we lose our motor racing correspondent, We go out and get another motivation correspondent. We don't have to sit there and wait for a particular month in the year when we can suddenly start appointing journalists.
Let's not think about a journalist transfer window.
But you know what I mean, Tom? In any business, if you're working in a bank or an insurance agency, any form of life, if you want to make a personnel change, you can make a personnel change. And it's no different. You're still weakening the opposition when you make that personnel change. If you go out and get someone else's, you know, if you get someone else who's got a lot of good accounts at an insurance brokers, I've never understood it. I thought the old system worked perfectly well. There was a logical cut-off. Towards the end of the season, to stop you actually materially influencing rivals and for want of a better phrase, corrupting the competition.
When was it roughly?
And it's okay. It's going back to
when was the cut? When you, when was the cut off?
Yeah,
I don't. It was around about the start of April, first week in April or whatever. If you wanted to bring that forward, if you want to make it March or whatever, it's entirely up to you. But I always thought that was. There was far less pressure on this. We've got to get it done. We've got to get it done. You know, the price is going up because, you know, it's got to be done before 11 o'clock tonight. And you think, why? Why? If you have the injury problem, say, that Liverpool had a few seasons ago when they had three or four injuries in the same centre-half position, why shouldn't you just be able to go out and try to resolve that in November? I don't understand a lot of the red tape because I look at it as people say, oh, football's a different business. I don't think it is a different business. I do think you should be able to, within reason, improve your staff at any stage in the season. And people say, oh, it leads to uncertainty and stuff. Yeah, good. Uncertainty can be quite interesting, actually, in a competitive sense.
On uncertainty, Gregor, did you ever move mid-season? Or was it always summer, end of contracts and things?
Did it once in January, yeah.
Did you?
Once or twice, maybe.
Was it ever any different going into a club halfway through the season compared to going in summer, training camp, get the fitness back, etc. at the same time?
It depends on the circumstances. I mean, like, so when I joined Northampton and Chris Wilder was there, we were in, like, a League Two relegation battle and he just completely tried to rip up the entire squad and get a new squad.
Had he joined and brought you in?
Yeah.
Right. So I'd say that's kind of, that's a little bit like everyone's in it, a new start.
It was, yeah.
Rather than you going into something that's already completely set up.
Yeah. No, I did that as well. Yeah, I think, but it's different. I mean, you're talking more here about, I think the kind of, the threat is about disrupting an opposition as well. And like, and potentially, that. You know, a team who's, under threat of relegation, sort of going out and spending a fortune just on that one-off, just to secure status, and you would see that happen in the Premier League now with the desperation that they have. So the thing would,
still happens in January. Though.
I know, yeah.
Birmingham City did it, didn't they? Can you remember Steve Bruce at Birmingham City?
I'm just trying to think what I don't really know what my view is about this. Like, I'd be totally fine with it being there'd be no transfer window, but I would want the cut-off point to be quite soon after January. I think because I do think there should be a sense of, like, you know what, you shouldn't be able to buy your way out of trouble, actually,
season. Fair enough.
Well, they've still got a few more days to surprise us. Maybe come Monday we'll have heard about loads more transfers and exciting rumours.
Tom, I just think that there's a sort of orthodoxy that has come about, and no one actually...
It's a show too, though.
No one actually asks the question anymore. It's sort of taken as read that there should be a transfer window and or two windows in which you can buy players, and all the debate is about those two windows and what you could do with them, and then we unilaterally closed ours, didn't we, and then realised what a terrible mistake that was. That was, like, ridiculous, and that's the debate, rather than anyone actually saying, what have we got a transfer window for in the first place? Why don't we have the old window that we used to have, whereby it was all of the season until towards the end you went, right, that's it. You know, if you haven't worked out what your squad should be by April the 1st or whatever, you know, you've got to live with it now. But I'm very happy to go with Gregor's halfway through February or whatever. You know, but I just do think I don't know why clubs like wrapping themselves in red tape like this.
I think just on the broader issue about like this month, I think we've got to remind ourselves that the summer was a record transfer spend, nearly 2.4 billion, I think. That may, you know, it's true that a lot of clubs now, they don't want to do their business in January because it is almost a sign of desperation. So I think they do
bulk buy in the
summer.
They
do it all in the summer, yeah. I think just I'm absolutely sure that Martin's right, that there is probably an element now of fear about, you know, the Premier League baring their teeth finally in terms of profit and sustainability rules. But they've also spent a lot of money in the summer.
Yeah. Well, if you've got views on what should happen with the future of the transfer window, or maybe you just want to tell us which side of the Darwin-Nunes debate that you're on, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Stick with us. We're going to be talking maybe about Beyonce next.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Martin Samuel and Gregor Robertson to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, and very specifically the stadium, I think, as Tottenham became London's richest club this week, thanks to Beyonce. Now, listeners, we have a little break halfway through the show, and we have a little pep talk. Martin Samuel liked to G me up every now and again about my little intros, and he said to me, Tom, I really, really loved your Beyonce references. So if, like him, you really enjoyed them or you've learnt something about her songbook, please do get in touch, tom.clark.
He's such a liar.
I am lying.
He's such a liar.
Slagging me off to high heaven, saying,
no one bloody knows. Tom, give it up. I'm sure she's married. You know, isn't she with someone? Is she with a fella?
I'm sure she's got a fella. Fairly successful bloke, yeah. Well, yeah, but he's never hosted this podcast, though, Jay-Z. He's welcome to,
honestly,
Jay, if you're listening, you're welcome to come in.
He reintroduced Ivan Toney at the weekend, didn't he?
He did, yeah, there you go. Anyway, back to Tottenham, back to Beyonce, and also the NFL, and all the other increased matchday revenues and concerts at the new stadium that helped Spurs overtake Chelsea, while Real Madrid have leapfrogged Manchester City at the top of Deloitte's Football Money League, as Martin Ziegler was discussing. Now, chaps, I do think this is very interesting. I was just going to go through the list from 1 down to 10. Real Madrid at the top, then Manchester City, then PSG, Barcelona in fourth, Manchester United still in the top five, Bayern Munich in sixth, then we've got an all-English club bottom four, Liverpool, Tottenham, Chelsea and Arsenal. Tottenham, as we say, overtaking Chelsea and Arsenal. The stadium factor is here what we want to talk about, isn't it? Because we think it's really interesting in terms of modern football going forward and the fact that Tottenham have been able to do this, and as much as it's not just Beyonce, as I keep referencing, there have been many big concerts there, Pink, Lady Gaga, Guns N' Roses. So fans of those artists, you can also get involved in the podcast. I'll try and mention them if you want to get in touch. But on this idea of the stadium, it was a long time coming, this Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. There was lots made about it, the decisions to move from White Hart Lane. But this is proof of modern football thinking, isn't it, Martin?
Yeah, it is. It's the, I suppose the headline here is how Tottenham grew to be the biggest club in London whilst winning absolutely nothing. Because that's the remarkable thing about this. This is not a financial success that has been built on sporting success. It's sporting success in its own way, because Tottenham have got into Europe quite regularly, have got into the Champions League, have got to a Champions League final, but they haven't actually won anything in the best part of two decades. And all of this has been done by monetising the stadium, the new stadium, monetising it as an arena. Outside football, monetizing match day revenue, and it's a very modern success story. And what it speaks to as well is the decision that other clubs have got to make. You know, I'm thinking of Chelsea, for instance. who have got a capacity of 41,000, 42,000 people. And so are falling behind every single time there's a match day. They are falling behind Tottenham and Arsenal, West Ham even. I'm looking at Newcastle, and again we come back to profit and sustainability, because we always come back to profit and sustainability, and Newcastle have suddenly realised they have got to try to find a way of monetising every single aspect of that club. So they've now appointed someone to be a head of partnerships, I want to say, not sponsorships, it's partnerships. It's that Manchester United model where they're going to have a partner for everything. If you've got a coffee cup, you know, they're going to have a coffee partner and a coffee cup partner. And
just to make sure you take the lid off.
Just to, yeah, and a coffee lid partner. and, you know, a Newcastle looking at that as well. But at the same time, what they have ruled out for the moment, and again, I'm not sure this couldn't ever be permanent, is a naming rights issue for St James's Park, because obviously the Sports Direct Arena went down so badly that there's a lot of scars from it. And Newcastle have obviously done a sort of research, a fan research project, and have backed away fairly quickly. But a way down the line, if they keep reinforcing this idea that to be able to compete, to be able to keep hold of our best players or bring other good players to the club, we need to monetise everything that moves. Maybe over time, the idea that it becomes the British Petroleum Arena or something like that is the future, because that's what modern football has been made to be about. It's been made to be about profit and sustainability. So suddenly everything is going to be for sale, and everything is going to be about, well, we need a 60,000 capacity stadium because we've got to be like Tottenham. And Tottenham managed to become the most financially successful club in London without actually winning something, just by getting 60,000 people to come to Tottenham Stadium every week.
Thinking about that point about stadium names and kind of fan ownership and feeling that connection, do we think something else that I think Tottenham have done incredibly well, and I've not been fortunate to go to a match there yet, but obviously everyone talks about the atmosphere being incredible. And I think sometimes, Greg, I don't know whether you'd agree, going to watch Football League games growing up maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there were a lot of new stadiums built that all felt the same after a while. There was a lot of stadiums. You know, my uncle's a Huddersfield fan, and they had that stadium built, which was quite forward-thinking. And then he, for a long time, went, they've all bloody copied our stadium. And it was like, yeah, they kind of have. They all felt the same. Do you think that's part of it as well, that Tottenham have not only managed to build a beautiful, brilliant, new, modern stadium that can house all these concerts, but they've also remembered the football side so that fans aren't going, you're money-grabbing so-and-sos, in the way that they might do with the naming thing? Is there something like that to think about? You have to make it. Because St James's Park, everyone talks about, oh, the atmosphere is incredible on special nights, etc., etc.
Yeah, you've got to...
You have to keep the football fans
in. You have to remember
in
what the club is about and what it's for. Yeah. That's absolutely... And look, you have to also remember that the Spurs Stadium came at the cost of £1 billion. So, like, not everyone is going to be spending that.
Yeah.
And, you know, they got you know, beautifully designed and you know, I have been, and if you go in the concourse, it's like every square inch is monetized again. You've got the kind of you know, the noodle bar and the burger thingy, and then obviously those fancy pints and everything, and it goes right round the entire you know, circumference of the stadium. So, and it's not just about the match day. That's the whole point. It's about what, you know, it's easily adapted to house other sports and to house concerts and everything. So, but the thing that leapt out for me as well is that you know, we're talking for the clubs around Tottenham, so Tottenham, Liverpool, Chelsea, their revenues are around about £500 million, just over.
Yeah.
Newcastle, down in 17th place, are half that.
Yeah.
So this is so important. Like, you can't underestimate how important this is, because obviously the higher your revenue, the more you can spend, because that's the way it relates to how much you can lose, your losses as well. You know, it does come back to Martin's point about how difficult it is to bridge that gap.
Oh, Newcastle are such a way off at the moment, Greg. They're so far off at the moment. And this is the thing. Newcastle are absolutely huge in Newcastle.
Mm.
But you never see a Newcastle shirt in the streets of London. Not the way you used to see Manchester United shirts and stuff when they were the best team. Not even the way you see Manchester City shirts.
Mm.
You never see a Newcastle shirt outside of Newcastle.
Do you think, going back to the Sports Direct point, that obviously with the ownership as it is now, for all we talk about sports washing and all that things, for Newcastle fans, it's a very good ownership in comparison to Mike Ashley, because it's a positive one that's chasing success.
Totally.
Do you not think that they could maybe then get away with a renaming in the way that the Sports Direct Arena came to symbolise the terrible ownership, if they consider to have good ownership now in terms of being successful and being ambitious and having financial backing? Do you not think that maybe they could get on board with a renaming? That wasn't as naff as the Sports Directory.
Well, that was my point, that I think over time, if they keep sort of hammering home this point about, look, this is all linked to how much we can spend, this is all linked to how good we can make our first team, that in the end, fans might come round to, well, okay, it's a necessary evil. Say, it would be easier if it was a new stadium outside of town, because it's easier to rename. You know, we were talking before, and it would have been a lot easier. It's been a lot easier for Arsenal to move to the Emirates Stadium than it would have been for Arsenal to redevelop Highbury and call that the Emirates Stadium. Everyone would have gone berserk because that's Highbury, and that's how, you know. But this is a strange thing. The way that football is increasingly set up, the ideal owner of Newcastle United, really, for what they want to achieve, was Mike Ashley, because he just ran it like it was an accountancy business, and that's what football has been turned into. It's just been turned into an extension of accountancy, and he ran it like an accountant wanted to run it. Disastrous if you're a football fan, disastrous if you want to go and watch the team, completely and utterly repellent to the people of Newcastle who wanted a successful football team. But I tell you what, profit and sustainability would have loved Mike Ashley. Look at this, look at this wonderful balance sheet we've got here. There's absolutely not a bit of red on it. Everything is, you know, that's fine. What the last thing that they seem to want at the moment is someone to get hold of Newcastle and go, I tell you what we're going to do here. We're going to have a right old go. We're going to see if we can get up there, and here we go. That's the last thing anyone wants.
Managed to find a reason to praise Mike Ashley.
But that's the whole point. I'm not praising Mike Ashley necessarily. What I'm saying is he ran a fantastic ship as far as profit and sustainability was concerned. Absolutely fantastic.
Speaking of the kind of management of clubs, Gregor, I touched on it there in terms of lower down the Football League. This is an issue for all clubs, isn't it? Working out how much revenue we can make, how much money we can make. You know, I think of clubs like Leyton Orient and other clubs that I go and watch Lincoln play in stadiums, and they've got flats attached to them.
Yeah.
Or, you know, function rooms, by the way,
who are about to fall off a cliff, Southend. And that was a property development project with a football club attached.
So yeah. No, you're quite right. But I'm saying that this is not just a Tottenham thing, is it? And everyone trying to get Beyonce and Guns N' Roses. It's for everyone to try and, you know, have other...
She's not coming, honestly.
Oh, could you imagine?
Like further down the pyramid, it's more like, can you put on a wedding on a Friday, and just monetize it throughout the week.
Business end of year.
Exactly. You have conferences and you have that kind of thing. It's slightly smaller scale, but it's absolutely the same thing. And that's why you've seen so many out of town stadiums that have like the land around it, the parking, they have all these things. And it's been to the detriment, I think, for the atmosphere and the sort of,
and also the feel of an away day as well, like that sense of, you know, that lost so much.
You're not
excitement
in the town
about
anymore.
Going to Luton away. A lot of Premier League fans, I'm sure, have gone, we've got to go to Luton, Kenilworth Road. Have you seen it? It's amazing. But you know, my club, Lincoln, as well, have had that thing of where our ground is 10,000 capacity. We don't really have any major function rooms and things. It's not a super duper stadium. And there was a conversation about building a new one out of town for, you know, 15,000 that could house concerts and things like that. And everyone's like, no, it'll take everything away. And even I was like that as well, because part of going on a match day with my dad, we walk down the same roads, etc. You can see the cathedral in the background.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I probably need to catch myself on if we're going to have any success going forward, because you might need to make that leap.
Yeah. When I was at Chesterfield, my first season we played in Saltergate, which was used for the filming of The Damned United.
It was so old.
There was like wooden seats, and it was like, you know, it was archaic. And then we moved into a new stadium, which was a little bit, and it was still kind of attached to the town, but a little bit further out of town. And we won the league in the first year, and our attendance has almost doubled. Mm. And they started to be able to get revenue.
See you, mate.
They started to be able to get revenue from other, you know, other streams. So, like, yeah, this is just an extension of that. But we have to say also that some clubs have kind of, obviously, it comes back to Martin's point. There are clubs like Man. Look at Man City. It's now £718 million in the space of what, 10-15 years. It's the increase is remarkable. And obviously some people have serious questions about how they've done that. But there are other clubs now who, just because of the time that they're getting the investment, or the owners are going to find it much harder to join the elite. And this is one way of doing it the right way, you know? It's like investing in infrastructure, investing in something that will get a return. And it essentially allows you to spend more on your team.
Sunderland, another good example, of course, of a team that moved to a big new stadium. I'll be going to see Bruce Springsteen there. Just wanted to get Bruce Springsteen mentioned on the podcast as well. He's another one. Bruce, if you want to come on.
All the Bruce Springsteen stuff that I like is the stuff when he doesn't sound like Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, really?
Like Philadelphia and stuff like that. When it doesn't sound. And it's a really good cover version of Dream Baby Dream by Suicide as well. Again, doesn't sound much like Bruce Springsteen.
Well, I love all your stuff, Bruce, so if you want to come on as well, you can come on. Bruce and Beyonce Game podcast
with
Martin Samuel.
They're going to have to form an orderly queue outside. Guns N' Roses, Beyonce. You know, amazingly, we couldn't get anyone to replace Cascarino today. We should have given Beyonce a call. You know, that would have... That would have sorted that one out.
I'm a dreamer, Martin.
Yeah,
you can say what you want.
But you're not the only one.
I'm very good.
Thank you.
Speaking of dreamers, the FA Cup. Oh, honestly, it's almost like we planned
it.
We genuinely didn't, though. That's wonderful. I can retire now, Beyonce, and seamless 1-2s with Martin Samuel. The FA Cup is back. In fact, it starts tonight, Bournemouth v Swansea. It's not great the way they spread the fixtures, is it, in my opinion? How many games at 3 o'clock on a Saturday? I think it's 4 out of all of them. And do we think they've maybe put the two best fixtures, as much as we all love Maidstone and the kind of romance of the cup, two of the best fixtures are on Friday night, aren't
Friday
they?
Friday night, yeah. In terms of Chelsea, Aston Villa. Just because of the situation with Chelsea at the moment, where Chelsea are always compelling at the moment. And, you know, Aston Villa are a very interesting team and a very interesting club at the moment. And on the up, so that's a good match. And Tottenham versus Manchester City is this saga where they've never scored there, have they, City? I don't think they've scored, I don't think they've won at Tottenham Stadium, and I don't think they've scored there either. I think they've been there 5 times and they're yet to score a goal at Tottenham Stadium.
Well, there you
I
go.
Think
you
that could be totally wrong, folks.
It's not done well there, though.
Yeah, but certainly they haven't done well. So they're two really good games, as much as Newport versus Manchester United is... You know, the romance of the cup, you always know, you know, it's something you find out at 90 minutes, if you know what I mean. When you're going in there, it's sort of like, oh, the romance of the cup. It could be 4-0 to Manchester United after 20 minutes and everyone's seeing what's on the other side. So Newport versus Manchester United could be one of the most romantic cup ties of all time.
Yeah.
Equally, it could be 2-0 to Manchester United.
Bristol City Forest as well, that's a bit of a dud. Who have we got to send to go into that one? Oh, sorry, Gregor, it's you.
Yeah, so they'll miss the two best games.
Yeah, exactly. how to spend your Friday night. Bristol City are quite exciting though, aren't they?
No, they are. I mean, I'm joking.
he's worried his press packs he's going to get rid of before he even gets
No, Liam Manning's, I think Liam Manning's interesting. I wrote a piece not so long ago about, he's one of a group of coaches who've been appointed in the last few months who never played really professionally. He's got kind of like 20 odd years in the bank as a coach before he's 40. Was associated with the City Football Group for a long time, worked in New York, and he did really well at MK Dons, then not so well, then was doing really well at Oxford and got this jump, and there's been promise in his early couple of months there, and I think he's an interesting coach. I think he's probably got quite a bright future, and there's a lot of good young players for Bristol City, who obviously knocked out your team in the last round, I wouldn't be too surprised to see them cause another upset.
In terms of the teams, you know, because there aren't lots of big shocks and upsets and things necessarily on the cards, Maidstone, we're rooting for you, as Newport, as are we. But the other teams that are still in there, I refer back to a conversation we had a few weeks ago before the third round, and with Johnny Northcroft talking about, I asked you ideally which teams would you like to win, and we kind of came up with a final that was Aston Villa Tottenham as the kind of good neutrals final. They're still in it, as a lot of other Premier League clubs are. Bournemouth are still in there under Iraola, doing very well this season. They could progress. Everton probably don't necessarily need a cup run, but maybe they do.
Everyone needs a cup run.
Everyone needs a cup run. There you go.
Everyone needs a cup run. Winning's a habit.
Fulham v Newcastle as well could be another group of teams that would like to progress in the cup. Would we rather see those teams and, you know, the Liverpools and Manchester United's, you know, fall away slightly? Chelsea. We want Villa to beat Chelsea, don't we?
Yeah, well, yeah, yes and no. I mean,
don't take that personally, Chelsea fans.
No,
we're
no,
just
exactly. You know, I'm not going to say I want Villa to beat Chelsea or Chelsea to beat Villa. I don't care. Apart from I've got a couple of family members that support Chelsea, so I like them to be happy. But I just think the giant killing stuff is great early on, and then when it gets to the last part of the tournament, you know, you want to see big matches and you know, big occasions. But all of those clubs you mentioned, they are huge clubs. Newcastle and Villa and you know, an FA Cup final with Newcastle. You know, if the FA Cup final was Newcastle versus Aston Villa, that's not a small match.
No.
That's two huge clubs, two wonderful historic clubs. That would be a great FA Cup final.
But two clubs who haven't necessarily been there and won it before. Yeah, it's got an originality factor that we should get
behind. Do you not think, Tom, there is a reason why we can all reel off, or maybe it's just me, that I can reel off every single FA Cup final I saw from as a kid all the way through, and then it gets towards this modern Premier League era, and then someone says, right, so who won the FA Cup in 2008 or whatever, you're like... I can't remember anymore. Mm. It'll be one of Liverpool, Chelsea, Arsenal, Manchester United. It'll be one of them, because it always was one of them. And
do we get
it's
good
the same
cup
with the
finals?
I was just going to say it's the same with the FL Cup. We just thought they're all like Borough and Fulham, but what's the final? It's the same final
we've seen it.
Penalties.
Yeah, but that's the other thing. Might go to penalties. I'm just thinking there with Martin when you were thinking about that list. Do we get good cup finals anymore? This is what I mean. I'm trying to kind of drum up the excitement and interest in these teams that are slightly below. Yeah. But that was that wasn't a classic game, though, was it? We were all delighted when
Tielemans
banged
one in. Like Yuri Tielemans' strike was a great moment.
But it wasn't a great game, was it? I'm trying to think of even...
Chelsea-Liverpool. I mean, Chelsea-Liverpool, I think, was it two goalless draws or whatever, Chelsea-Liverpool? I don't remember them being bad matches. I remember them being quite good matches, just with no goals. I don't necessarily think they're bad games, but they're not memorable in the way that they used to be, because there was more romance, there was more backstory in FA Cup finals. It's not just a nostalgia thing, I don't think, for the past, because I look at the, you know, I think I said it on here a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks ago, that the West Ham Arsenal final in 1980, if someone had said to me on that day, you're watching the last team from outside the top division to win the FA Cup final, he'd have gone, no, what are you talking about? You're 30, what? You know, and it's 34 years now. No, it's not. It's 44
years. 44
years,
yeah.
There you go.
Musical that's, reference, yeah. top yeah, dollar, maths, yeah, not yeah, such
yeah,
a strong suit.
No, absolutely,
on the game,
yeah. There's maths teachers from Milford County High passing out, going out, useless, always was useless. We thought he was figure blind. So 44 years.
Yeah.
Nearly half a century. You would have, on that day, anybody that you said that to would have gone, no, of course, no, it will happen in 5 or 6 years' time, same as it did with Southampton and, you know, all of these things, Sunderland and everything. They were very recent memories. But now it tends to be a team from one of those elite clubs, the breakaway six. Call it the breakaway six.
Well, if us grumpy buggers haven't managed to get you excited for the fourth round of the FA Cup, make sure you check out the Times website, because there's more excellent features on there. Paul Hurst and Gary Jacob have spoken to players, coaches and fans who were there for Tottenham 3, Manchester City 4 back in 2004. Anyone remember who got the winner for City that day? They were 3-0 down at half-time, came back to win.
I wasn't at that match. Where was I that day?
Anyone remember?
I can't think.
One of his few goals for Manchester City, John Macken.
John Macken.
John Macken.
Well, we would have been here all day.
Definitely.
Yeah,
there would be more chance of Beyonce turning up than me getting that one right. I must come. Oh, here she is, look.
Excellent. Don't get me too excited. We've nearly managed to get
She's
it through the
whole. She's been rugby tackled by Bruce Springsteen in the desperation of getting to meet Tom Clark.
Oh, honestly. I've gone all a fluster now. I can't compose myself. Martin Samuel, Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. We've had a right laugh, haven't we? You've made me a happy lad. You might even say you've made me crazy in love. Thank you. Oh, One more. Come on. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We'll be back on Monday with lots more football insight and probably no more mentions of Beyonce.